Hey, yo, what is a cypher?
We actually had to lose one of our first members because of a photo shoot.
The knowledge of the cypher is to enlighten you.
Where you think the cypher come from? The gods.
Because you tried to jump the cypher and it goes this way.
Welcome to The Cypher, a podcast bringing you talks with the most interesting figures in hip-hop and culture. I'm your host, Sean Sotero. This is episode 235, a conversation with Destroy and Q Unique of The Arsonists. The Arsonists were a crew formed in Bushwick in the early 1990s. Destroy, who began his rap career in his early teens alongside famed DJ Tony Touch in the duo Touch and Destroy, helped to form a crew that would eventually come to consist of, among others, Freestyle, Jice One, Swell Boogie, and Q Unique. After putting out several early singles, the group was the first hip-hop act to sign to Matador Records, a label better known for indie rock. They released their debut album As the World Burns in 1999. An intense touring schedule and its attendant stresses put pressure on the crew, and it splintered after the 2001 follow-up Date of Birth, on which Destroy did not appear. Q Unique, for his part, went on to team up with Ill Bill, releasing music on the rapper's label Uncle Howie Records and touring with his group Nonfiction. In fact, it was on one of those tours, the Warped Tour in summer 2004, where Q and I first met, something we remembered when we reconnected for this interview. Q Unique has since gone on to release a number of solo and collaborative projects, which you'll hear about during this episode. Destroy has released solo music and has also become a successful event host and actor. But the Arsonists are back with a new album, Lost in the Fire, and a reissued version of their debut. Lost in the Fire features a mix of old but previously unreleased material alongside new songs, and it was that project's release that brought Destroy and Q Unique to my apartment in Flatbush to talk. If you like the show, please check out our Patreon at patreon.com/thecyphershow. Every new patron helps Josh come up with new punchlines for his next lunchroom rap battle. Also, we know some of you want shirts and other stuff, so please go to merch.thecyphershow.com and get yourself a t-shirt. If you want to know any of the songs we're playing during this episode, visit thecyphershow.com to find a complete list and the show notes. While you're there, sign up for our monthly newsletter to stay on top of what's going on with The Cypher. And now, here's two guys who could teach Ringo Starr a thing or two, Destroy and Q Unique of The Arsonists. Here with the Arsonists.
Yes.
Destroy and Q Unique.
Yes, sir.
We're here, man.
Who I have a secret history with Q Unique.
Yes, man.
Going back a long time. We were talking about it.
Punk rock history, man.
I love it. That's great.
Exactly. Yeah. And you guys obviously have a much longer history going back to the Bushwick Bomb Squad.
Yes.
What exactly was that? Was that a group of friends? Was it like a graph?
Well, the Bushwick Bomb Squad was just, you know, growing up, you know, everybody had a crew. And that was Bushwick Bomb Squad, and inspired by Public Enemy's production crew, of course. And then it became a point where the music was kind of taking off, and I was very serious about it. And I just wanted to kind of do away with all the extra guys who weren't necessarily rappers or DJs or anything like that. And then, Kinetic was like, you know, let's do the Arsonists. Let's call it the Arsonists. The Arsonists worked out. And then that was shit, like a week later, Q came into the fold. It was like everything was like perfect timing.
Mm. But there was a particular event that brought that on, right?
So what was going on is that we had a reputation of doing ciphers, and I definitely was in the Village in Manhattan battling and everything. And Ching Rock, one of the members, was still super active in the Arsonists at that moment. And all of us were a very early morning, 3 in the morning? Q was there. It was like 2 in the morning, something like that. And there was a gang called the Latin Kings at the time. And one of them were trying to battle me. And I had my reputation in the neighborhood and knew who was an MC. But if you were open to battle, then I was down. I was always down for it. So I noticed with MCs, as Q also knows, there's always check words. If you freestyle and you're not really like comfortable with it.
If you're stuck, you'll repeat the same word every 2 or 3 words.
Right. So this kid's check where it was, I guarantee. So I kept saying in my response when he already said his first part, my first entrance was, I guarantee. I just kept saying, I guarantee, I guarantee. That's
just to kind of fuck with him.
Yeah, exactly. Because I knew
it was a battle.
I knew it was his weakness. Mm. And then I thought that was the reason why everything had happened. But one of the members, Swell, also told me, I said that I'll turn your crown upside down and put it in your ass or something like that. I don't remember that, but it does sound like something I would have said in a freestyle. But, you know, from there, it just went south.
It was a mess.
Yeah, the dude snuffed me, and I was like, whoa, taken aback, because I've from all the years of me battling, I never seen it get physical like that. But I kind of thought, I kind of felt that, you know, it was a different energy. I've battled there before. You know, I've battled people with actual reputations as MCs there. So for it to get that part, I was taken aback by it. But while I'm thinking about all of that, it's nothing but chaos right in front of me. It's just everybody's just going at it, and
people pulling out razors.
Yeah, it was very bad.
It was a mess.
And you know, we were you know, known in the neighborhood, you know, and so was that gang, and they were prominent in numbers, and we were prominent in more love and culture for what we were doing for hip hop. So we cared about the spirit of it. But then
Tony Touch and Crazy Legs had to actually step up and
I think it was
help
really,
us out with situation.
Yeah, it was definitely Tony who stepped in, because I went to Q's, who lived in deep in Brooklyn at the time. Like, yeah, I don't know what's happening. Yeah, a lot of people knew where I lived. My brother had a reputation, so you know, you just don't know what's what. You don't know what's happening, because we left it, and usually
we weren't on any gang shit. Bottom line,
and usually the way things like that end is super extra violent, you know what I mean? And we knew that the spirit that brought us to that place and that moment was just hip-hop, you know. So all that other stuff was just, you know, I'm told later, more jealousy, envy. But what's great is that not only that Tony helped out and kind of figuring out who was the leader, and we sat down and to this, you know, to when that happened, you know, I remember Ching not backing down and still willing to still fight. And but that's how, you know, thought, you know, it was, you know, you're playing a thin line between the streets and the culture of hip hop. So, you know, it gets blurred, especially with individuals when you involve their history in the streets. The funny thing is that later on, they do an article in the Source magazine about Latin Kings.
And the guy who punched me in the face,
and the kid
is
who,
like dead
who
center.
Snuffed me, got like his own page, not as an MC, just like as a gang member.
It was crazy.
And I was like, what the fuck? And we were still trying so hard to become, you know, still the arsonist and get in the Source. And these guys got in there for being in a gang.
Crazy. So Q, what were you doing before joining the arsonist?
I was in a group called the Nomads. Chopped Herring Records actually just released a small EP on that.
In August 2017, Chopped Herring Records released 7 tracks on the throwback EP 1992 to 1995.
It involved Skef Anselm from the guy who did Tribe Called Quest, mm-hmm. Brand Nubians.
Former guest of the show. Episode.
198.
Oh, okay. There you go. He was a very influential person in that mix. You know, we were doing shows here and there. We put out a little single and stuff. And eventually, me and Destroy met up. I've been training martial arts, and my martial arts instructor happened to open up a martial arts school right next to David Letterman's on Broadway. And he happened to roll through with Tony Touch. And it was at the end of the day, and somebody started a rhyme cipher. And I didn't know who he was, but I remember his energy was crazy. And he was talking about being on welfare, but it was funny. Like, it wasn't like he was like, yo, I'm all, it was more like, I love being on welfare. I'm crazy. And you know, everybody's just like staring, like, what's wrong with this guy? You know, like, and so I kept it in my mind, like, yo, this dude's pretty cool. And then, we ended up meeting up again at a Death Row Records. They had a party which
I was gonna ask about that
we don't even fit that mold.
The Death Row plays an important role.
Isn't that crazy?
Yeah, so
all of those documentaries and movies about Death Row, we'll never be in them.
So, to let you know, Tony's car got broke into that day at the karate school location. But what it was me and Tony was doing promo for Death Row, and we were driving around a lot of Death Row people, which was funny around that time. And they were like, all right, tell us what's hot right now. And then we'd be like, you know, Mobb Deep got a new joint. Right. And they'd be like, fuck out of here. And we'd be like, what? You know? And they were like, that's neighborhood music. That's, we call that borough music. That's not getting out the boroughs. And, you know, me and Tony would do shows wearing Death Row Records merch.
Yeah.
You know?
Isn't that crazy?
It's so retarded. So it was a dinner. It was a dinner at Jimmy's Bronx Cafe.
That's like where Fat Joe used to hang out with Big Pun and them. Like the,
yeah.
So the most unlikely characters in the whole circle.
Yeah, so he was, like, this was through Nomads. His, what was the name of the guy that ran the
Buddha
label?
Buddha Sess.
Buddha Sess was a street promo
and
dude.
And Al Pizarro.
Al Pizarro is a veteran record promoter who is best known for his work with VIP Record Pool and Heavy Rotation Promotion, where he worked with the likes of Dr. Dre, Snoop Dogg, Eminem, and Ice Cube.
You're right. So Buddha Sess was a street promo dude for his label.
Yeah.
And we were, me and Tony, though we were touching Detroit, we was still like, you know, promoting stuff as well. So
Buddha Sess brought us to the Jimmy
Yeah, so Def Row had like a dinner for all the promo cats.
Free food, we there.
Yeah, and this guy comes, I sit across and he reminds me about the karate school thing and all that stuff like that. And then that's where we kind of hit it off.
And then he's like, yo, you just come roll
need
through
a place
Bushwick.
To sleep.
Come, nah, he's skipping, but yeah. Pretty much come to Bushwick, you know, come hang out. And it was mind blowing because the Nomads thing, it ended and it ended on a dark note. So I didn't know what was going to be next. So
it was all timing, right?
Yeah, crazy, the right? Timing is crazy. And I remember going from the Nomads and I remember Skef showing me some things that were adjustments to my rhyme style. And then going to just on the first day, going to hang with them. And it was like I was already down. They were so welcoming. And it was like an extreme dose of MCing. Like you walk in, there's like 53,000 MCs in his house, in his living room. And this, you walk in and the cypher's already happening. People are rhyming and they're everybody's out to prove themselves. And I remember, I think we stopped and then he took me to like two or three house parties and then we came back and we're talking hip hop. And I remember going home with my mind blown because I was in search of something
it's
that would just...
It's a great feeling, man.
You know,
it, to hear you say that.
You know, you're in search for something to help you in your evolution. And you're given a high-level dose of something. Because prior to that, the biggest thing in my life was being a member of Rocksteady. But that doesn't necessarily fit what I'm trying to do. I'm an MC. That's a B-boy crew. Right. It was amazing to be a part of that. But to walk into something where it's exactly what you're looking for, and it's on a high level, a raw, like, raw, untouched, organic, gluten-free fucking level, man. It was incredible.
The first track you ever recorded, was the session the first thing you did?
Halloween was the first.
Halloween was the first.
So you're with the liars, the bootleg buyers, because nowadays niggas want to play the Michael Myers. Arsonist sex fires.
So Halloween was recorded...
as a demo
course,
first.
Yeah, it was recorded as a demo.
Was it over Ill and Al Scratch's beat?
It was over Ill and Al Scratch's beat across the street in Kinetic's house.
There you go.
And, you know, we did a kind of cassette type thing. And then, no lie, man, this guy came in. Like, when he came in, there was a lot of MCs in the house, you know. And there's a thing of consistency. Like, if you just keep coming, you know, you showing up. And he just...
He just proved himself
worthy, you know, to the whole movement. And he was, you know, aside from me, he was, he had Nomads out, you know what I mean? And, you know, Freestyle, another one, he was battling. Like, I met him as a battle MC. So those two guys, I was kind of really looking
at. We were already in the field, like, you know, we had a record out.
They weren't just friends, like.
Which is important to you, because you'd been... a professional rapper more or less since you were like 14 years old.
Well, I was lucky with with the Tony Touch wave. When Tony started doing his mixtapes, he wasn't Tony Touch yet. You know, he was Tony Touch, but he wasn't that legend that he became. And I just was with him through all that time.
I wouldn't even say lucky. He's being modest. I think, speaking from the outside, something that had to happen because he's a highly skilled lyricist. He's just very skilled. And I'm not talking lyricism on a level of like a Pharoah Monch where it's scientifical and mathematical and you have to sit there and decode it. Destroy just comes from a different planet where he's a natural where some people have to really figure. I remember one time, you know what? It was the night after we finished hanging out at the Jimmy Bronx Cafe or right before. I remember going out to meet Tony Touch and he's in the front seat and he's just rapping. Like not blinking an eye, like a beat is playing and he's rapping. And it impacted me because it just, from that point on, it just always kept me on my toes. I knew that I was behind as far as being in the Nomads because we weren't as top of our game. And then going into this circle with him and Freestyle and the rest of the guys, it just put me on notice, like, hey, you know, step up your bars. So it was very serious.
Yeah. The mixtape stuff you were doing with Tony, it's interesting because even at how young you were when you started, there were like song concepts. You were actually writing some coherent stuff back then.
Why they call you Destroy?
Because I'm known for fucking shit up. I can take a slow jam and roughing it up. Yes, I'm the crazy lost case. Mad ass brother with ill type of flavor that's up on some other shit.
Yeah, you're around that time. I mean, I started, you know, the first thing I wrote was like a parody of Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer. And then a friend asked me to write a rhyme about Thurgood Marshall. And, you know, I was like...
Wait, was that for like a school project?
Yeah, yeah. They were both school projects. The first Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer one, I won a trip to go skiing with a bunch of kids. Oh, and I took Kinetic.
Wow. Do you remember any of it? Can we hear some of it?
It was called Ronnie the Ridiculous Reindeer. It was about a retarded reindeer.
Wow.
And I'm sorry if I'm politically incorrect. I call them midgets when you're supposed to refer to them as elves.
No. Unbelievable.
What's the one of the early songs you did with him? The
with Tony?
I'm not real or...
Oh, I guess I ain't real to you.
I guess I ain't real, yeah.
I guess I ain't real to you, because I don't smoke blunt, sell drugs, or drink brew. With my crew, we recognize what's true. Microphone checker 1-2.
Because Tony was a big weed head. He was like super... you know,
was?
Yeah. You know, he smoked a lot of weed. And I was rolling with him, and I just didn't feel... even at that young age that I needed to keep up with anybody. So if that was what made a person real, I didn't need to be that because I knew who I was. And in my neighborhood, this, like, you're a mess, you know, just being from my neighborhood. So, you know, whatever you, if you think smoking weed made you real, then I'm not real to you.
Yeah. It was a great song. And
thank
so
you.
When did the idea come to you? There's going to be an album.
That didn't come to way later with Matador. When they said, we're going to do this, we're like, oh, okay, we got to put this together now. Because we were just on record mode for years.
To give you a perspective, and I'm kind of liking the way this whole thing is going because it opens me up to a couple of things that I admire. And the reason why I love this guy Q so much, because he's saying a lot of things that I forget, you know what I mean? But what happens is me and Tony were in a group for about 5-6 years, you know, Touch and Destroy. And we did about 9 songs in those 5-6 years. And his work ethic was sick, but on the DJ end, you know, and when I started really taking the whole Arsonist thing serious and making music, he could tell you, and he just did, where we were doing like 100 songs a year.
Every day we were recording.
We were on it, you know, and we were making these lists. There was like, there were Bible long pages of just all these
songs.
Just
to give you an idea, we put out that double album and those demos.
Yeah.
That's just a fraction of what we could leak.
And that was just
too much.
That was really, you know, and I don't mind speaking about it now. There was a moment where, and this guy was with me when Tony was like, he seen us gaining traction with Fondalum because we released our first single with Bobbito.
First single, Session, backed with Halloween, was released in 1996 on Fondalum Records, the label created and owned by Bobbito Garcia, best known for his time as one half of the legendary Stretch Armstrong and Bobbito radio show on WKCR. Bondalem is perhaps most recognized for releasing early work by MF Doom.
And he was like, wait, what's going on here? You know what I mean? Because he was down, but he was also Tony. So he couldn't come to the house, hang out. You know what I mean? When dude shot up my house, he dropped me off, stood for a second and left. But the rest of Arsonists just stood and they talked to me about it. You know what I mean? They consoled me. And things like that made my relationship with the Arsonists very strong, you know, because it was grounded. I seen Jice cry over being messed with by the police officers. You know what I mean? And
I had to live in his house because
these were like real things. Yeah. He seen my father wild out on my brother, and yeah. You know, he'd seen a lot of dark shit. And I'm not gonna take anything away from my relationship with Tony. I loved it because
it was a different kind of relationship.
Yeah, I got to, you know, do a lot of amazing stuff with him. But when Tony was like, "Yo, you're gonna have to make a decision. Is it gonna be, you know, touch and destroy or the Arsonists?" And I was like, I'm gonna just go. Why don't you just tell me what was your? Because you sat there.
When you look at it now, it's so unnecessary. Because I think that if we would have just came together thinking, it's one of those things you wish you'd think the way you now back then. Because then you could just organize it in a way where you do that, and we'll do this, and we'll do this, and we'll have this Wu-Tang agenda.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Of spreading across the map and taking over, but. For some reason, it just, you had too many egos.
It was definitely, he was at that time.
He's a controlling person.
He was definitely, yeah, Tony Touch at that moment. You know what I mean? And he paid a lot of fucking dues. And you know, down the line later on, we were always thinking about like, shit, we never had a Damon Dash. We never had Diddy. We never had an Evil D.
And you know what? Another thing that he probably would have helped us with, and he was on to something correct, was he felt that there was just too many arsonists. And he was right. He was right. In hindsight, he was right. I won't say who or...
Yeah, it's the same reason why the Bushwick Bomb Squad had to get cut down. You know, there had to be another phase, but, you know, it was like a loyalty thing.
Yeah. And, we were young and we just looked at it like, well, you know, we want to keep this family together.
Yeah.
And in his mind, he was thinking more music business, which was the right way, because that's what we wanted to do, where he was like, I think we should just mess with this guy, and maybe this guy, and then the rest gotta go. And that was hard for us to hear.
In those pre-Matador days, like, how many people, looking back, would you consider to have been part of the Arsonists?
Let's count them, because we tried yesterday.
So
we started,
you have
yesterday.
Ching, Kinetic, Swell, Jice, Freestyle, me, Destroy, Spin One, Neil Armstrong. You had in the Outer Circle, Groovy
Tony,
Lou,
yeah, Tony.
Tony Touch, Pop Rec.
Yep.
And then we had like these soldiers that would just sell merch for us. So we had Snoop, yeah. We had Step, we had Carl Omar.
We had a lot of, it was massive, man. And people who used to just sit, just to chill.
They loved the vibe. We were in the middle of the hood. Yeah. We were in the middle of the hood and we were fun.
Yeah.
So you can't how could you not want to be a part of that?
My house was the kind of open door policy. My parents it was passed down, that vibe from my parents. They had everybody their age would just come in, and you know, I've seen
music.
Yeah.
So you guys have 10 core members and 5 auxiliary members.
Yeah.
It was massive, well, Scott.
What happens when you have to like start taking pictures and start putting people on album covers?
We tried. Early pictures of like 9-10 dudes in the picture, and
we do.
Actually had to lose one of our first members because of a photo shoot.
What happened?
One of them, you know, wasn't happy with the positioning of the members in the photo shoot.
You know, you become in those scenarios of ego as well. Like, hold on, this guy's
a lot of alpha male
trying to be the star, you know, and none of us were really trying to move in that direction. We were more like, at least I was very happy to just be part of the conversation. You know, even though it all started at the crib, I was just, you know, knew that this was the movement it needed to be in. So if I was on the side or in the middle or high or low, me personally, I didn't care. But, you know, some people thought differently. And, you know,
there was a little thing. Somebody got punched in the face and we had to kick out our first member. Like,
because of that. Yeah. Because they swang on another member. And we're brothers. And I know brothers do fight. But, you know, we're trying to do something bigger than emotional, you know, history and all that.
We just didn't. For some reason, I mean, I guess I probably would have tolerated it now more, but we just didn't want to tolerate that kind of behavior. Interesting, you know, as young as we were, we definitely got on each other's nerves, but we never wanted it to get physical.
What was going on with Matador? How did they enter the picture? Because I remember them from, you know, Guided by Voices or whatever, right?
Pavement.
Yeah.
Formed in 1989 and had critical and commercial success throughout the 90s with rock acts like Liz Phair, Superchunk, Teenage Fan Club, Guided by Voices, and Pavement. The Arsonists, as you'll hear, were the label's first hip-hop act.
What's amazing about Matador, and it's something that we were just talking about, we didn't shop to them. And that's the best feeling in the world. They actually went, they heard, they, we had a buzz as far as our performance. People loved the way we just performed on stage. They caught wind of it. They went to Fat Beats. They bought the Fondulum Records, the Searchlight record, went back, fell in love with it, and then came back to Fat Beats, talked to me on the spot. They probably called Candy on the record, maybe.
On the Arsonist's second single, Venom, the artwork lists the number of their manager, Candy.
And we went up there. And right, it's interesting because prior to that, 321 Records was trying to do something with us, which was where we did the 14 years of rap song with Nonfiction.
Iceberg, your brain state got your mind sick and open like the Fat Beat sign. Literate, illiterate, you can't read between the lines. I'm 10 times the pen rhymes you write on blue line. Exaggerated.
And it didn't work out. And I remember right before that, we went up to Raucous. And I forgot who I was talking to, but he was being a real dick because I was like, you know, I we have this pending deal with Matador. We want to see if you'd be interested in the Arsonists. He was like, I'm not signing 5-member groups right now. It's like, who said, you know, thinking now, it's like, who says something that stupid, you know? But it worked out for the best because Matador was the correct fit for us. To this day, I wish I was still there. That's how perfect it was for the Arsonists. It was like tailor-made.
Was there pressure of like, we have to represent all of rap to this label? We're the only rap group on it?
No. I if anything, we might have put pressure on ourselves because they kind of alluded to, hey, you know, we don't really know this genre, but we really want to do this. And the funny thing is, everything that they did was dope. So it was like they didn't really need to know anything. I think we as the Arsonists overthought things. So we kind of like muscled our way into their offices and became a pain in the ass at times. But looking at what they did for us, it wasn't even like our promo, our press was insane. They had us in everything. So they were doing their job. They were above and beyond anything we needed, coming from Fondulum, that, you know, thankful to Bob that he did that he put those records out and he put us on our first big show in Europe. But what Matador did, they were a blessing for us, man. We didn't know how to behave with it.
So tell me about the road, because one of the things that rock bands do, obviously, is tour insanely. And you guys were touring a lot in an era when rap groups were just starting to do that, right? There was you guys and the Rhymesayers and Def Jux and whoever were just kind of starting to take that indie rock model and apply it to the rap world.
That was the attraction, that I can see also regarding Matador coming over to the Arsonists. We did have a reputation for, with these 12-inch singles, we were traveling throughout Europe and touring successfully. And finance sponsored tours as well. So it was a very good thing for us to do. We also had a great live show, you know, and the great live show helped us continue to the trend of hitting the road. And Matador, they had that mentality for us, and we didn't know, but we were just doing it. You know, I'm sure somebody's told, yo, you have to tour. And we were like, we were already just in that mode. So as he said about Babito when he first brought us to Denmark, and we did in front of 50,000 people opening up for Kraftwerk and Black Sabbath, you know, that was our first show in Europe. And it just went on from there for us to have this, great response in Europe with a lot of fans over on that end was very supportive of what we were doing.
And I got to ask them about the first Matador album, which is, I hope I'm not blowing up your spot.
Okay.
But how the fuck did you get away with having a Beatles sample on that album? It sounded to me like there was an end of the end of Day in the Life, the like, string thing.
I think that on that line, I think you should freestyle.
Yo, punch me in.
Dice.
That shit sounds
swell.
Yo, what the hell are we paying you?
These stories.
Yo, punch me in right after. Few unique. Yo, we got to double up on the hook. You still recording?
We're going to feature.
It's Beatlesque.
Sorry.
It's Beatlesque. It definitely. Yeah, I know. I know exactly where you're talking. Yeah, it's Beatlesque.
Okay.
I'm a big Beatles, influence, so that definitely played a part in that. I had the owner of the studio, his dad played multiple instruments, so he came in and I told him.
Okay, so it was just like a string swell,
yes.
Kind of like
yeah.
That. Okay.
Yeah.
So it's like they don't clear shit.
No. Like. No.
Well, me and
you and
Sonny Bono.
You and Ringo Starr hang out.
Yeah. Skied once and he was there skiing.
Yeah.
Ringo fucking Starr.
Really?
Yeah.
That's fucking cool.
But skiing isn't a metaphor for anything.
No, no.
No, like skiing.
No,
like,
no.
We were not doing cocaine.
So a couple songs on that first record I wanted to ask about. Q, since I have you here, the rhyme Time Travel.
Yes.
It's so funny and it's so kind
Thank
of
you.
Spot on. Can you talk about coming
yes.
up with that?
There's a lot of stories behind that
including
song.
Including making the punchlines era appropriate.
So initially when I wrote that song, let's talk about how I came up with that song. I was doing an off-Broadway play with Rocksteady. And what was rough about doing the play was, you, as an MC, you're trying to compete with these dancers and they have all these routines. And I'm like, who the hell wants to watch me? That's boring.
Yeah.
So I was like digging in my brain to come up with something that would, you know, intertwine with what they were doing. And when we were doing it in Performance Space 122, I would try to come up with different things. And one of the shows, I came up with that where I said, well, I'm with these B-boys. Let me go through the years. And so I did that. So I had a rough idea of it. And then when Arsonist album was being put together, I knew that I wanted to bring that idea to Wax. And what's interesting is that all three of those rhymes actually come from moments in my rhyme book.
Send him 1979, 1988, and 1999.
The C to the D, come on, party people, get whipped in. Swinging, I give you what you need, and just check the rhyme as I proceed.
Force of one, vocally sprayed by poetic machine gun. Acknowledge existence of a prodigy born son. Even the odds divide, come up with a sum, and the remainder will be one.
All throughout the seasonal, the epitome of hip hop locks my chord. The track wards and spider rap overlords. When from out of the heaven, street lessons of battle tactics and rhythm speak. Cue you in the art of studying the 1200 technique.
They were naturally written. It wasn't like I had a gimmick and I was like, let me try to sound. No, I actually wrote those at certain age periods of my life. The middle one, the fast one, that's 88.
The, like Kane style one.
Yes.
Yeah.
That was actually going to be my first single when I was signed in 1989. That Crazy Legs got me my first record deal on Celluloid Records. And the record label went bankrupt. So all I had was the demo on cassette and the instrumental on cassette. So I had to refeed it, redo it, and manipulate it where it just went through the years. So that's how that whole song came together.
And the funniest part for me is actually the end where you're making fun of what was then the current, you know,
yes, yeah, that fast
scene,
machine
right.
gun and right. slow beat, fast
big,
rhyme,
big words.
Yes,
yeah.
Yes, and trying to be, you know what? If we were just surrounded by it, and one of the guys in our crew, Kinetic, was like a master at it. So, you know, being around it so much, and it was the thing to do back then. You didn't really try to follow the beat. You just try to say a whole lot of shit within 2 minutes of a verse. So that was just trying to capture that moment. So,
yeah. So it was kind of a loving making fun of,
yeah,
of
yeah.
that style.
I at the time I respected it because I didn't do it, but I knew that Company Flow was big on that. And I knew that Kinetic, to me, was a master at it. You know, I remember people really digging his style at that time because of that, you know, that whole delivery.
One thing I noticed about is when it comes to the hook, each time it comes around, most of the times you guys only say it once.
Really?
And do the hook once. Probably. And then kind of on to the next, on to back to the verse.
Hey, yo, Q. I don't trust as far as I can spit. Heads is full of shit and slit the throat as soon as I turn my back and stab.
We love rapping, man. Back then.
Yeah.
Yeah, there wasn't, you know, once again, as I said, as far as like coaches or like, you know, seniors who could be like, you know, do the song like this. We did know there was some structure, you know, but at times, you know, we had somebody like, you know, Halloween. Who was the one that freestyle raps forever? Seed. Yeah, which is another song that doesn't really have a...
The era of that time was the true era of Hot 16s. Everybody talks about, oh, spit a Hot 16. When we were coming up, that was the time when Hot 16 really meant Hot 16. So in The Arsonist, you could see that everybody's trying to outdo each other in a very brotherly way, where, you know, we're going to every... The chorus, the hook was meant for a breather, we knew that we had to make it work for the crowd, yeah. But we were more focused on the 16 bars. Yeah.
And how was Lunchroom Takeout recorded? Like, were the reactions real? What was going on with that?
And it was funny, shut up, dummy. Learn how to speak. That's why your girl and your moms told me to sperm on a cheek. Now you done did it. You tried to battle me, and you got calm looks. You about to come get burnt like all the food that your mom cooks. And then 1 minute later...
No, the reactions weren't real.
He did that. You
I did that on... We had our headquarters in my apartment. And I had a table, and I sampled the kick like that, and the snare like this, and I put it in the MPC, and I kept it on beat. And first take, we just let Scott and Swell battle each other, and then from there, I think I have it on tape or that. And then I went back with them, and I told them pick out your best stuff because it can't be this long. Right. It was like 20 minutes.
Right. Uh-huh. Yeah, and you don't want to hear an actual of a lunch period or whatever.
And we had to come in and do the reactions in the background because their rhyme sucked on that.
It was fun.
It was more of the vibe of trying to capture that whole lunch. And I remember we were mad because the Roots ended up doing it like two albums later.
A brother who don't claim or aim to be a preacher or ordained. I have black thoughts, therefore my name is the same, no question. My ability and a studio facility as I utilize my God-given utility. On time, I get behind and push along a rhyme of mine.
And everybody was like, did you hear the Roots doing it? And we were like, we did that like 5 years ago, yeah. Man. Yeah.
Why was it important to have legs on the album in the interlude?
It's like East and Zero T. It's just straight up on skills. This is Crazy Legs from the Rock Steady Crew. I'm out.
Hip-hop was... Richard Crazy Legs Colon is a b-boying pioneer and the longtime president of the Rock Steady Crew. You can hear more from him on episode 218.
He gave us our first show at the Rock Steady Crew, Rock Steady Anniversary.
Right, and he was also with you and also me.
We were all members of the Rock Steady Crew at that. He made us... Like members of the Rock City, he took advantage of us. Now
he
liked us until we broke up. Once we broke up, everybody got kicked out except for me.
Yeah,
but
for me to be down with Rock Steady Crew, I had to graduate from high school, and
that's right.
For that reason, I stood in high school in my 20s. Fuck that. That was my attitude. I was so mad that they told me that bullshit.
Is that true? They really made you?
It's a true story. Tony, Crazy Legs, asked Tony. This is early days. Because I was with, you know, like Legs. And, my first show was in Connecticut with you.
Yeah,
you know,
me, he was Crazy Legs.
He was still in Nomads. And that was with the Furious Five or something like that.
We did a show opening up for Grandmaster Flash and the Furious Five.
I was crazy when I became.
We're not that old, by the way.
I became.
This wasn't like the messenger.
No.
I was young. When I was the hype man, when I was OC's hype man, Eclipse. That's how I met Eclipse. He drove me to Philly, and in the back seat was Crazy Legs.
Wow.
The whole trip. So you know, Crazy Legs and me and Tone and of course later on him. We was always
in the same circles.
Yeah. So it was like, is D a rock steady? Are you going to put him down? And then I don't know if it was Crazy Legs or Tony who said, you got to get your high school diploma.
But then he ended up putting us down on stage at one of the events. He put the entire arsonist down.
Yeah, but I was so rebellious towards
him. Yeah, I know.
Fuck that.
And to this day, he still is.
I won't graduate for me, and I'm going to graduate for Rocksteady.
That's funny.
One of the things that happened with the arsonist around like the time of the first album was you guys were held in direct opposition to the kind of mainstream shiny suit, bad boy,
the same thing.
Did you ever find that limiting that people thought of you, oh, you're just on the other end of those guys?
There's a very interesting thing that we both dropped our albums on the same day, us and Puff Daddy. And, you know, we come from, of course we were hip hop kids, but we were dancers too. You know, I'm not speaking for everyone, but I know I was in clubs. So I was dancing to a lot of the, whatever the quote unquote jiggy stuff was, you know what I mean? And shit, we were rhyming to everything.
What I did, the only thing I didn't like, people making us the breakdancing rappers. It was so inaccurate and it would get under my skin a lot.
Yeah.
That was the only thing that felt limiting, because I felt that we were strong enough to be taken seriously. And I think people would get distracted about, a lot of the times people would get distracted. So it would bother me with those kind of reviews of, you know, the guys that dance and rap, and it's like, no.
And we were definitely pegged because of the spectrum that you said. We were underground. We were the people under the stairs. We were,
rap group, man.
No, I know. But that's how we were referred to in the Source magazine. We were like in the dark. We were like in the tunnels, like that, in the sewers. Like, that's how we were referred to. And then it was everybody else. And we were like, wait, hold on.
What's stupid? Right. You know what's stupid about that? It's like he just said before. Our first show, we're opening up for Marilyn Manson, Kraftwerk, uh-huh, and Black Sabbath. Uh-huh. We go back. We open up for Blink 182 and the Gypsy Kings. Uh-huh. We go on tour with Public Enemy and the Roots. Uh-huh. So it's like, how could we be that underground, but yet here we are with some of the biggest bands. And one of my schedules, we did a show, we opened up for Public Enemy, and we shared the stage with Korn.
Yeah.
So it's like, if we're that underground, how are we pulling this off? Right. So it's like, a lot of it was inaccurate because they wanted to peg us.
They have to.
Because of a sound.
They have to peg you. They have to categorize you. That's how it works.
I wanted to actually jump back for a second, Destroy, because I was thinking about when you were doing stuff with Tony, when you were in Touch and Destroy.
Uh-huh.
We were 14, 15, 16.
Uh-huh.
And I was thinking, man, if I was doing anything that cool when I was like 14, 15, 16, yeah, no one would have been able to tell me shit. I was just wondering, like, what you were like back then.
He was a nightmare.
I was definitely a wilder kid. You know, I was super wild. Tony was like the only person who was like, it was really wild. Because he honed in my energy. You know what I mean? When I walked into the record store and I watched him scratching, I was kind of designed for that moment. You know what I mean? I was watching Video Music Box. I was digesting a lot of Law Finesse. And then I meet him and he's like, come to the house. And he took like what I was doing with the fellas, Bushwick Bomb Squad, and was like a serious version of it. And then I was like, okay. And then I would meet Evil D. And I knew that I knew I was special in my way, where I was wilding, you know what I mean? I would like do something nice with him, and then I'll come over here and I'll do something bad, you know, but just with a whole different circle of people, as long as he didn't know. You know, I wanted to make sure that he approved of what I was doing. But I was from Bushwick, around a lot of bad negative influences. But when it started becoming that I was more the dude from the mixtapes and not so much Junebug's little brother. You know, it started feeling I was coming into my own. And, you know, me and Q recently had a funny moment about this Junebug's little brother. So my brother was me with a criminal record, just like a very, very raw version of whatever.
The same like outgoing comic.
No. Yeah. Yeah, like what, like it wasn't, it was funny, but from afar, that's how he was funny, you know. And you know, growing up and kind of getting my name through the neighborhood was really dope, you know. It was really, really cool. Also in high school, I was, you know, oh snap, you're always on Video Music Box giving shout outs, you know. And Tony was like, you know, bringing me along, and that's how I met this guy. And was on G-Bo the Pro and Double R's mixtapes. And yeah, I was kicking it with legends. You know what I mean?
What was your relationship with the X-Men? Because you did the Rock Raiders mixtape. You did a mixtape for Sinister.
Yeah.
The arsonist about to get live for the X-Men. DJ Rock Raider, Mr. Sinister. Rob Swift. I be Q Unique. I'm first to bat. Check it out like this.
I'm forth the wire off the rack. Echo shirt to clothes my back and all of that. I'll outstep your breath. Fuck that. Let's sinister back and forth. Top of the globe. Call me North. I'll interrupt your mainstream radio listening like a special report.
There was a circle, right? So you had the X-Men. You had Company Flow, the Juggernauts, Stronghold, Nonfiction. So it was like we had this scene. I guess it's almost like that CBGB scene where there's all these bands that mingle together. It was the same thing. We all did the same venues. We all tried to do records with each other, hang out with each other because it was our scene, you know? So that's how the relationship started. So whenever they had their mixtape coming out, they would reach out to whoever.
It seemed appropriate. Yeah. We had the ability to do it. At this time, we had a setup. So we had a setup in Q's house first, and I had a really trash setup, and then Q's was a more serious setup, and then he moved over to my house, and then that became the new spot. And then
we did Raiders first, then we did Sinisters, we did Total Eclipses mixtape.
Yeah, and
Rob Swift is a snob. He never asked us to.
We also ended up doing DJ Camillo's mixtapes.
Have competition running like a candidate, vote for me. Y'all tax the mic around for the people, aside for whack rappers, all MCs are created equal. From off the steeple, seeing Jice on the Camillo sequel.
Spin one, you know, it was a good run, and then I had the good fortune to end up being...
We all did Tony Touch as well.
Yeah. As individuals, right.
Yeah. What's up? It's the Nomads, Q Unique and Groovy Lou. About to flip it on this Tony Touch Rap 45. Like yet that. Another chapter in the Arsonist family, baby.
And then I had the good fortune to end up being the Executioner's tour MC.
What was that like? Because I, when Rob Swift was on the show, I told him I remembered seeing him in 04, I was talking to Q about this off mic, and he was playing in front of a rock. They were playing in front of a rock audience, and it was not a good reception.
Yeah, we actually got booed in Cleveland because they were doing what is New York City has a summer jam, and pretty much every state radio station has a summer jam. And they were doing the rock versions of all these summer jams, and they were the one hip-hop group, and the reason why they put them in there because they have the song with Linkin Park. So in some cities it worked, the crowds were open-minded. Some were rough. Detroit was rough, but they laid on, you know, it had to grow. I knew Cleveland was like, what the fuck is going on? But there was a time, I remember when
we did a show
with the Beat Junkies in Switzerland, and you know, we performed on stage and then the Beat Junkies go on, and this is before DJs running as a performer was a thing. So people are looking at the stage and they're like, are we supposed to be dancing? We don't know what we... And I remember some drunk dude got on the mic and he's like, what's going on? He grabbed the mic and everything. He's like, I don't know what to do. But, you know, yeah, it was interesting in that way. But, you know, it took off for those guys. We ended up doing, you know, the Aerosmith, MTV Icons, Anger Management, Sobe Tour, the X Games Awards. It found its lane, and it's great because, you know, it its evolution and its genres kind of like getting in bed together, doing greatness.
Yeah, I think rock audiences eventually got used to it. They were like, okay, well, I'm used to seeing people shred on guitar, so I guess I can figure out.
And then Slipknot, you got groups like Slipknot and Linkin Park that started adding scratching to their
And their sound. Know, the Judgment Night soundtrack was one of the first that really opened people up to that world. Yeah.
The soundtrack to the 1993 film Judgment Night was released in September 93. Every track was a collaboration between a rap artist and a rock band. For example, the Onyx and Biohazard track heard here.
I don't want to go too much into the breakup of The Arsonists because you guys have talked about that a lot in other interviews and that the stresses of the road got to you, all that kind of stuff. One thing I was curious about, Destroy, from your point of view, what was it like listening to an Arsonists album you had nothing to do with?
Listening to the second album as an MC, you know, first I know they are...
Keep it real, son.
I know they're releasing another album. So now I'm like, wait, hold on. You know what I mean? So I'm listening to that project more as they went from being allies to competition now. Because you look at everything at this moment... And coming up, I was ready to battle everybody. I was when I met Das FX, I wanted to battle them. You know what I mean? That's how my mentality was. Yeah. So when that happens, you're like, okay, let's wait if there's a line about me. You know what I mean? And that's really how I listened to it. I didn't listen to it as a fan yet. I didn't listen to it as a, you know, the beats. I was just like, fucking, where's it? Give me the fucking food. I just want the food. You know what I mean? And I never really got that satisfaction. So now I had to listen to it like, oh, I like this beat. Okay, Cycle Less is on it. All right, this is good. I see where they had to fill up, you know, the gap on energy and where the other guys had to step up, you know. So it turned from me not getting what I wanted. You know, I wanted that because I knew that was the one thing I could answer. As far as like reviewing the album, that was kind of corny because it's like, why would I review it? You know, why would somebody ask me to do it and get my opinion on that? I've moved on. That's the only thing that would have stuck me to it if there was a line that I couldn't really be like.
So Q, were there lines about him that he just didn't catch?
Yeah, there was like 10 of them.
There was one later on.
That Swell said something where he said, I got new friends, some of my old pals were whack. That's the probably worst line I've ever heard of my life.
Yeah, it wasn't.
So it's like, you know, in hindsight, I wish we didn't put out that album. It's one of those things where I enjoyed the moment of being with Swell and Jice because they're great fucking guys and I love them. They're my brothers. But it's one of those things that we just were making a string of just bad decision after bad decision after bad decision after, because there were a lot of emotions involved and a lot of selfishness going on, a lot of alpha male bullshit. So I would have preferred to have the entire cast on that album, especially since I produced the whole fucking thing. That would have been a moment for me. You know, it is what it is, and it's and it came out on 9/11, which is it's cryptic as shit. So, you know, and Matador put us on tour months after the event happened in Manhattan. So having to go around the United States at such a dark point, and I think we went out with Mixmaster Mike and DJ Swamp.
Yep.
Nobody wanted to come out. Nobody.
Was there ever a point post that album up until this, you got this one together, when it was ever decided officially the Arsonists are broken up? Was that ever a thing?
It was for me when Ill Bill said, what are you doing? He heard whatever I had left over, date of birth. He was like, you need to do your own album. Then Swell said, Bill's right. You need to.
And so to you at that point, there was no more Arsonists.
Yeah, there was nobody going to hold it together. I know Q was a pillar in the group.
So now to the new album. So what is it? What happened? How did it happen?
It's just the smorgasbord of mess.
A whole lot of drugs. Me and Ringo Starr doing skiing in my nose.
What I'm most fond of, and it's because of a recent reaction, is on Lost in the Fire, you have from the original Pyromaniacs to the end are these songs. These songs were made during As the World Burns, before As the World Burns, during, and a little bit after. And the reason why I'm so fond of these songs is because the songs themselves are moments in our lives. So if you know what happened behind the scenes, where we were, the vibe, and then one of our family members, Ching, he's like being reinstated. It's like a moment of reinstatement for him because he was the first member that we had to let go of when we was talking earlier. So for him to hear his voice finally on the CD and
explore life through a mask, then they wonder how a shiny ass day turns gray with mad rain and thunder. Confusing to blame when you got mass stress, but you want to be down and catch a hole in your chest. Every day is
and to catch that, you had to see his excitement. Like, yeah, he's like, it was almost like a brand new record, and yeah, and Drake was on the hook. Like, yeah, he was really excited. So to get that kind of a response, it wasn't even, I didn't even care at that point about what outsiders were thinking. I was more like, look, Ching's happy. And that means a lot because I know he's facing some real like health issues. So to see him have a moment of happiness, uh-huh, and especially what he's been facing lately, is like, man, perfect timing, man. Perfect, yeah, timing.
You look at, I think the whole thing on the package on both that, of course, the As the World Burns and then the Lost in the Fire, it's a vibe that was always there with The Arsonist and how it was created. When you listen, you hear people laughing, but like genuine laughing. And, you know, we had a lot of fun creating it. So if there was anything, it was also, that was lost. You know, even though growing up where we grew up, there's a lot of funny individuals in the hood, we just felt that we were able to put a little bit of that into song and a little bit of that energy into music as well and bring it to hip hop. So in a project like this, we just feel it was necessary to continue that in 2018 to whoever those remaining Arsonist fans are there, or people who ever walked into a Fat Beats and bought a vinyl anywhere, or just know of Stretch and Bob, or just remember this era. That's kind of the reason why we really went on and said, you know, let's put this together and make it
happen. You know what's crazy? I was just thinking of, I had to put this out there as a little factoid. Sparkum, on that second Lost in the Fire, Sparkum in an AEIOU, that was going to be the third Fondalum release. But if you try to gas me, you regret it. I'm known for blowing spots while I keep the lyrics unleaded. Rhyming with the full tank, driving by the corner bank. But the mic began to stall, had to fuck with the crank. Please.
The first alphabet, yeah, the letter A. Combined it with the skills and the microphone, I slay. So hey, parlay with me today. The swell got more game than the show Richard Bay. Time to leave and go.
And then Matador came in and signed us, so it never happened. But that was going to be the next record we were going to put out with Bobbito. Like, we were set to get that out. So we would have officially had three singles with him. Uh-huh. So, you know what? Judging by that and looking at what he did with MF Doom, he probably would have put out the first Arsonist album.
Yeah.
If nothing was going to jump off.
Right.
But it was that Matador came in, so the record never happened.
Kira, I read something you said about going back and revisiting the space of the Arsonist now is different because Bushwick is different.
Hip-hop for us is different.
Yeah.
He and I, we had a moment of reality, like a massive reality slap where we're talking. Because I've been trying to release his material. I had to actually leak one of his songs recently. And, you know, when you go back and you look at the reasons why you did something and they no longer exist, it kind of like puts a twist on what you're doing. So now you're trying to find different reasons to maintain this this thing that you love, because all the venues that we perform that are gone.
Uh-huh. The magazines.
The magazines are gone.
Personalities
and characters. The vibe, the places where he lived, where I live, they're gone.
Yeah,
we're not there anymore. You know, so it makes it very difficult. We did make an attempt to go to Pennsylvania and rent like a log cabin and get people.
We made a couple attempts. We had everybody come into Q's crib. We did a photo shoot.
Couldn't get everybody on the same page.
We did a recording session. Yeah. We tried to have the beats, but, you know, as evolution, everybody moves into other things that are interesting to them. And me and this guy, I just said it recently in a conversation with him. I still hit, you know, witness great things in our conversation and still have epiphanies like, word, like, you know, we still learn things just about the industry because we're both in it. You know what I mean? Right. Where, you know, the other guys, you know, do what they do. But, you know, it's a really good ride. And, you know, to be able to do this is a great thing.
And, you know, D-Stroy, while you're here, I wanted to actually ask about hosting. I just talked to Cypher Sounds not long ago, who is another person who started out, I guess he started as a DJ, not as a rapper, but has transitioned into a lot of hosting duties. So it got me thinking about that. What makes a good host?
What makes a good host? Someone that understands that the event is bigger than themselves. Depending the event, you have to sell a feeling, a vibe, and also depending, once again, if brands are involved, you have to kind of like be able to mention these brands where it doesn't seem so much like a commercial, where it seems very natural. If it's a hip hop event, you have to understand that people, you know, the technical difficulties. You know, one time I hosted a DJ battle for Red Bull, and one of the turntable sets went out, and they were going crazy. And it was 45 minutes I had to buy. Yeah. And I started saying jokes. I pulled up two of the worst people to battle against each other in a rap battle. But let me take it to a greater thing because I love this moment. I had to do the first Wu-Tang show in Staten Island after Wu-Tang found their success. Meaning that they've never performed after 36 Chambers as all Wu-Tang in Staten Island. So what happens is Mathematics, their DJ, Rebel, gives me the cue and they say, okay, introduce them. It's in a little venue, you know, fitting people who have their Wu-Tang polos from Space Bags, the Wu-Wear. They had all types of stuff there. And, you know, and I do the big buildup, you know what I mean? All right, y'all. You know, and I got a heavy, you know, I go in because I want it to be such an impact. And like I said, I know it's bigger than me. I know it's about the moment. And here I am selling the moment. And Mathematics is like looking over like, nah, yo, turntable don't work. And I was like, what? And once again, they're going crazy. Like, what the fuck's going to, you know? So this is the worst, most amazing time of my life as
worst,
a host.
Most amazing.
So I have to stall for 30 minutes to a bunch of
Wu fans
from Staten Island who barely never get a show. When was the last time you went to a show in Staten Island, right? So I'm looking at everybody and I'm going into my joke book. I'm doing hip hop trivia. And then it looked like it was a point where it was going to be like, all right, this dude, D-Stroy, is going to get punched in the dick. Something's going to happen. So there was this woman there who looked like she could beat up bouncers, right? And she had a hat on that had three letters. And usually if it's three letters, it's a gang or a crew. So let's, you know, I was like, yo, my homegirl right there. And I was joking with her, you know, getting her on my side. And I gave a shout out to whatever was the hat. And then like I noticed a whole bunch of people were like, oh, like I knew them. So they thought I was like, I was down now. Like, oh, okay. So here I go. I'm like, all right, who could name people who were not in the Wu-Tang that was introduced by Wu-Tang? So I make it like a game show. And she's like the leader who will beat anybody up. So, you know, they're all looking at her like, oh, okay, you know, you better answer his questions. So they never got violent with me. They never got aggressive because she was laughing the whole time.
You happened to read the right person's hat.
Yes. Yeah. And her energy. I read her energy because she was like this the whole time. And she was like the first one to be like, no, where the fuck is Ghostface? And I was like, what's up, girl? How you doing? You know, I had to cater to her. And, you know, next you know, Mathematic looks at me. He's like, yo, we ready to run. And I'm like, oh, my God, everybody. Make some noise for Wu-Tang.
Perfect.
And I go slice my room.
You didn't
try
to get five more minutes to finish your routine?
I was done. I was done. Red Bull ended up paying me a lot more money because of that.
Right.
Yeah.
You've done a lot of hosting. I watched your reel.
Uh-huh.
You've done a lot of different kinds of events.
Yeah, of course.
What are maybe some of the weirdest ones or strangest ones?
I did a film festival in Berlin where this dude showed up with no clothes on.
Nice.
I did a snowboard event, a competition where a dude did a trick and broke his leg and I couldn't acknowledge it. And his leg was broken like it was detached from his whole shit.
So wait, you were hosting and there's someone presumably yes. behind you.
And I know, I just hyped him up. All right, Eric's going to go down. Here goes Eric in a 920. And then he goes and all you hear in the background is, but I can't acknowledge it because you know it doesn't play well for the company.
That's brilliant,
man. Yeah, I've a lot of interesting situations. You know, from you know Allen Iverson, you know, doing his birthday party and him having a bottle of Cristal, and I'm like, yo, I never had Cristal in my life, and he was like, you what? And he gets another bottle of Cristal and he pops it, and right in front of me, he pours the whole Cristal on the floor. And I'm like, oh, my God.
Why?
Yeah. And he was just like, you know, basically calling me a bitch without calling me a bitch. You know what I mean? So I went and LeBron James and Wade are playing cards. You know what I mean? And they're all like chuckling. And I'm like, damn, B, I just can't introduce the Roots. Why you got to do me like that? But I have two Cristal bottles in my house to this day from that event party. That I jacked. Yeah, but yeah, I've done a lot of interesting events. You know, I've done a lot of shit. Yeah.
And Q, we were talking before Mike that after the Warped Tour in 2004, yes. we were both on. You decided to go out the following year with a band.
Yes, I. It was all part of a evolutionary process for me. One thing led to another. Just to make a long story short. From the Vans Warped Tour, putting together a band and messing around with that. One thing led to another. I got a phone call from Bobby Ruiz, who is the president of Tribal Gear. It's a clothing company in San Diego. And he asked me, hey, would you ever want to do a record with Fieldy from Korn? And I was like, sure. Like, I didn't think anything of it, you know, because, you know, in hip hop, you're featured here, you're featured there. So I fly out, we record, like, we meet, we go eat. We come back to his studio and we start working on stuff. I bring my drum machine with me. He's got his bass. One thing leads to another. We record a song. I come back home and I forget about it. I didn't even think anything of it. And I get a call like, yo, what are you doing with that song from Bobby? He's like, I'm like, you know, just nothing. Why?
Listening to it? I don't know. What are you,
and
what
he's
do
like,
you do with this
he's
song?
Like, dude, that's Fieldy from Korn. Are you crazy? Like, let's go get it done. So I get it done. Fieldy shows up. He hears it. He's loving it.
Alone in a crowded room, killing myself to live. All the voices in my head saying, killing myself to live. I'm going through withdrawal and I'm killing myself to live. I swear I'll change tomorrow, killing myself to live. I look for
silence. And he's like, hey, dude, what are you doing right now? I'm like, nothing. He's like, yeah, you want to go on a roll with us? I'm like, sure. It ends up becoming this 11-year journey. Changes my life. It changes my musical. It's one of those things that you just don't see coming. You know, I thought that I was going to be on the road with like Jay-Z or something. And here I am writing records with Fieldy from Korn and putting together a band with him.
I'm split between rapping and metal, from Walker with Jesus and Kanye to Slayer's Pact with the Devil.
That band is Stillwell. The other members besides Q Unique and guitarist Reginald Fieldy Arvizu are drummer Noah Wolf Bernardo of POD and Pablo Spider Silva on bass.
And learning new musical things that I just didn't think that I could ever do or accomplish. And he and I put out three albums together. Two of them were rock. One of them I produced his bass solo album, which is more jazz and funk. And then it led me to where I am now, which is I'm in a band called King's Bounty that I put together. And it's been doing great. We did a week with Korn. We did a couple of shows with POD. We opened up for Seven Dust. And it's getting me in business. It's getting me more attention than what I do with hip hop, which is bizarre for me because I didn't anticipate that. Yeah. I remember one time being on stage while Korn was performing and Fieldy in the middle of the set as they're performing. He runs over to me. I'm on the side. I'm just watching Korn. He comes and goes, isn't it weird that you're here right now? Like, it doesn't make sense, does it? And I'm looking at him like, what? He goes, it just doesn't. And then he goes back and he starts playing on stage. And I was like, it's like, and it's been that surreal, you know? So just like him, I have those kind of stories, but with metal bands, like, you know, recording a song for Chi from the Deftones, and here I am with the bass player from Metallica, and he's recording his bass into my laptop, and I have to put it together and produce it, and it's him, and it's the guy from Disturbed, and I'm backstage with the biggest bands that you could ever imagine, and I'm just a fly on the wall, and I'm learning. But it was this 11-year thing that it was like going back to school. It was like what I did with hip hop. It was like I was uprooted and I was like put back into kindergarten and I was pushed to learn a whole new machine. So in 11 years, I was put in the one of the top notch schools in the world. I was in Korn school. Mm-hmm. And I just watched their whole system because they brought me into meetings with managers and they brought me up to record labels with them. And when they signed to Rock Nation, I was like the sixth member of Korn. And I'm standing there like, and they're like, why is he here? And I'm like, you know, so it was like, it changed my life.
Wow.
Like that.
And so you have your band now?
Yes.
Destroy, what are you doing? You're hosting? What else going on?
Doing Cocaine with Ringo Starr. Title this interview, Cocaine with Ringo Starr. Nah, I'm great, man. I'm still, you know.
Did the NFL thing.
Yeah, I just did the Super Bowl. I just
what did you do at the Super Bowl? It's,
I hosted this event.
Not breezed by that. Yeah.
I hosted this event for the league, where I interview current stars and legends, you know, about the game, and kind of do Q&A with fans. Get the crowd going. I it's really funny the stuff that I do because it's more.
Actually, what he does is unlikely too because he's not a sports guy like that. Like, you know, like.
Yeah, actually, he's funny because he tells me that and he's true because Great Scott's a basketball dude and he was
it's
like,
it's trippy
how
to see. It's like, how is you? How are you?
Yeah, I'll call him from Yankee Stadium.
Like, do you know who so and so is?
Yeah, like, I'm like, I don't know what the fuck.
It's weird. It's like, but he's in the mix and you like you see some of the things he posts and I'm like. He's chilling with LeBron James or
yeah.
He just took a picture.
He came to the Brooklyn one, to the New York one.
That's crazy. Or you did the Q&A with you know, and Super Bowl champ Long, Howie Long's son.
Yeah, who's Chris,
who's
Long.
Chris Long, who's a Super Bowl champ, yeah. Who actually made big news because he didn't want to go visit Trump. So he did a whole Q&A with that guy. Yeah. So it was like, you know, those things are highly unlikely for yeah. Where we're at right now in our lives. It doesn't make any sense.
Yeah, we did well, and it's good to see that we've both evolved. And one time I was doing this event for BET at the BET Awards, and somebody's like, Destroy. I was at Prince's house recently at Justin Timberlake's party, and this dude's looking at me, and I'm in a conversation with someone else, and I can tell he's looking at me, and I'm like, what's up, bro? And he's like, you Destroy from the Arsonist? And it's crazy. You know, it's crazy, and that's a beautiful thing when I do a Nike event and the guy is transporting me to my vehicle and he's telling me Q Unique's Father's Day.
Yeah.
He's telling, you know, he's quoting his verses, and I'm like, you know, it's great to see that the people have evolved as well.
I know it's also the impact of our music because the same thing for him. Like I've been at Korn meet and greets. And somebody will be like, you're Q Unique from the Arsonist. And I'm like, yo, we're backstage at a Korn meet and greet. And yeah. This person's pointing me out. That's crazy because yeah. It's the wrong crowd. It's not that it's the wrong crowd. It's just
it's
not
the
crowd that you
it's
think.
Yeah.
You know, so
it's definitely a trip.
Or going up to BBC and there's Harvey and he's walking past Korn to uh-huh. Come say hi to me. And the same thing happened when we went up to Rock Nation. Bekas was up there.
Yeah.
And here I am. I'm, like I said, I'm the sixth member. I'm just standing there. And he looks at the entire band and he goes, hey, what's up, Q? And they're all like,
yeah,
looking
yeah.
at me like, who, what?
Yeah, it's a trip.
So it's trippy because our music, it made a mark. As much as people wanted to bury it in this under the stairs thing, it resonated.
Yeah. We knew, and I should say, I know that if somebody comes to me and they tell me they are a fan of the Arsonist, that it wasn't artificial. I know that they weren't introduced to it because it was sponsored by Sprite or
paid for on the radio,
or paid for on the radio or anything like that. We knew that it was organic, and that's a great thing.
Awesome. And so just one last thing. What do you want to, you know, accomplish by putting this out, by re-releasing the old album, by putting out the new project? Why do this now?
It's closure.
Yeah.
We kind of like left it in the air when Date of Birth came out. When our contract ran out with Matador, they pulled it off iTunes. So there was this void where, you know, every now and then you have somebody saying, I want to listen to that album. That's my favorite album. And we did try.
It was about a 10-year process from the conversation to now, to it being real. And you know, I'm really happy that we're in this juncture, because I get to, I'm not gonna lie, like some things in this conversation are very eye opening, because you kind of close some of there was a lot of dark shit in the beginning. And you know, overall, I'm sure for
the whole ride,
you know,
was kind of crazy.
Yeah. So just to know that it could come to this point where people could appreciate it after the fact. And they also say things like stories like, hey, I remember buying it in Phoenix, Arizona at this store. Oh, I remember seeing you guys in Amsterdam. Or, you know, these things bring hip hop together. It's the reason why me and Q came together, because of hip hop. There was no other thing. It's a great thing when the fans could kind of tell you a deeper story, and they could revert back to things like we said earlier, Stretching Bobbito, buying vinyl, having cassettes, you know, stuff like that.
It's closing the book, man. That's it. You know, this is it. I don't foresee any more material as far as new. You know, we our legacy was given back to us once that contract ran out.
Right.
And we had to keep it there.
And we are in conversations for down the line for a vinyl release.
Yes.
of some songs. And those first six songs on Lost in the Fire are technically new. And along those lines, there were also other songs that were created, that were recorded, that we are still kind of having conversations in regards to, me and Q-Unique.
Trying to maintain the Arsonist vibe, but yeah, trying to maintain the Arsonist vibe.
All right. Awesome. Well, that sounds like a great place to end. Q-Unique, Destroy, thanks for coming
back. Thank you.
Thank you.
If you live in New York City and are remotely connected to hip hop, you've probably seen Destroy perform at least a few times. Whether it's rapping or hosting, he's an energetic and memorable entertainer. But to hear how he got there and what the Arsonist legacy still means to him was surprising and touching. As for Q, I hadn't talked to him in over a decade, but it felt like it had been no time at all. And I found it fascinating to hear both about his time with the Arsonists, but also about his transition into the metal world. Join us in 2 weeks when we have the return of Jean Grey and Quelle Chris. They have a fantastic brand new album out called Everything's Fine, and we'll find out all about it. To make sure you hear each episode of The Cypher as soon as it comes out, subscribe on Apple Podcasts or whatever podcast app you use. Make sure you check out our archives when you're there. If you like this episode, you should listen to episode 216 with Rock of Helta Skelta for more Tony Touch stories. By the way, if you use Apple Podcasts to listen, go now and give us a rating and a review. It's by far the easiest way to help us out, which is why every podcast you listen to wants you to do it. Seriously, go now and do it. And you can really help us by becoming a patron. Visit us at patreon.com/thecyphershow and sign up. Bringing you each episode takes at least 20 hours of work, and we could really use the support. If even 20% of you gave us just a buck a month, I could finally afford to get the Judgment Night soundtrack on vinyl. And again, go buy a shirt, a mug, or whatever you want at merch.thecyphershow.com. You can find us at The Cypher Show on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. Follow us and let us know what you thought of this episode and who you'd like to see on the show in the future. More information about anything related to the podcast, playlists, our complete archives, and more can be found for free at thecyphershow.com. The Cypher is created and written by Sean Tataro.
He smoked a lot of weed.
The show is produced and engineered by Josh Cross at Crosstown Studios.
Free food, we there.
Our music is by 42 Ghosts.
Give me the fucking food. I just want the food. You know what I mean?
Our web guru is Aaron Young.
Who actually made big news because he didn't want to go visit Trump.
Audio editing by Rob Van Vranken.
I was very happy to just be part of the conversation.
Special thanks to Patreon supporter Simon Wimmer.
People pulling out razors.
Yeah.
We'll see you next time around on The Cypher.
I kept on asking him, are people getting me out? I'm like, are they? Because you want a journalistic mind to sit, review it,